All right. Okay. For those of you who were not able to be with us last week, we're on the back side of our lesson handout. We actually moved from the stage of all of the things that are happening on the front page are basically in the first five books of the Old Testament. And so, you know, you see, we spent a lot of time and a lot of focus on all of these events that are the events themselves mainly happening in the first two books, Genesis and Exodus, and then, you know, mentioning a lot, some of the other things going on in the other three. Just within those first five books, there's a lot of history. There's a lot of information, and keep in mind, again, all we're doing is just kind of surveying here. So you can see just from that how much is going on in this part of the Bible, and we're barely scratching the surface. But what we're doing is we're covering, again, key people and key events, okay? So we move on to the back side here, and the back page is going to cover even more time in terms of the Bible history itself. But we have fewer things listed on here. So the point here is I want to encourage you to go and search and read and study up on these things to fill in all of this information that we have, because you see from the top of this page we've got the story of Joshua, and then we go down all the way through the book of Revelation. So we're basically in this section going to cover, you know, the rest of the Bible. Okay. Now, last week we were talking about, we looked at Joshua taking over the leadership of the Israelite people as Moses died. Joshua is the one who is charged with leading the people of Israel into the promised land. They cross the Jordan River. They go in there, and we talked about what kind of a campaign is this that they're doing. What kind of leader it was Joshua? He's a military leader. They're going to go in, and they're going to fight battles to conquer the land. The first battle that they encounter is what? Jericho. They come to the city of Jericho, and this is the story of the walls of Jericho coming down, and they go in and destroy everything and everybody and so forth. So this military campaign has occurred through the time of Joshua. Joshua is leading the people, and for the most part, they are, you know, living the way they're supposed to, although not tremendously different than they were under Moses' leadership. There are times of faithfulness and times of disobedience and so forth. After Joshua dies, we saw last week, what happens to the leadership of the Israelite people? Okay. Well, even before that, though, we end up with the time of the judges, where they don't have any real recognized leadership other than the high priest. And the priests are basically religious leaders. We don't really have any designated or recognized military leaders. And basically it's a time when the people don't have any leadership, basically, and they're kind of doing their own thing. And what happens is, remember what we talked about last week, we look at the book of Judges, and this period of history is generally referred to as what?
The cycle of the judges.
And the reason it's called that is because of this cycle that the Israelite people go through, where they're obedient to God for a while, and because of their obedience, they're living in a time of peace, and everything's going well. But after a time, you know, they start to forget about God and they start disobeying and they're not obeying God anymore. So God allows them to be oppressed by their enemies. And then after a while of that, they call out to God for deliverance. We're sorry. They repent. God sends a deliverer in the form of a judge, which was generally a military leader that would come and gather the people together and lead them militarily against their enemies, conquer their enemies, and then they would have peace for a while, and they would be obedient and so forth, and then after a while they would become disobedient and the whole thing would start all over again. And that's why it's referred to as the cycle of the judges, because it just keeps going round and round and round. Again, last week we mentioned a couple of different of the most well-known judges. When you think about the judges, who are some of those you think about? Samson, Deborah, Gideon, those kind of folks. But I want to encourage you again, I always encourage you to read the Bible, okay? Go in there and read some of this and get the meat of these stories. A lot of really interesting stories about some of the things that that are occurring there. Perhaps, though Deborah being a woman judge during this time, and of course, you know, a lot of the ladies like to, you know, focus on Deborah because, you know, she was a woman and she was a leader of God's people and so forth. But Deborah really is not as well known as perhaps Samson and Gideon, probably the two best well known stories of this particular period. Of course, what do we know about Samson? What kind of a guy was he? Samson was a strong man, okay? Samson, somebody once said, I read here just recently, somebody was talking about Samson probably being the best comedian in all of the Bible because he brought down the house. Anyway, it wasn't my joke, it was somebody else's. Anyway, of course, Samson was the one with all of the strength. And where was his strength found? It was in his hair. I don't know what kind of shampoo he used, but you know, it was something. And you know, but he had his strength in his hair. And of course, the story is of Delilah, who you know found out what his secret was, cut off his hair, and the Philistines were then able to subdue him. They blinded him and made a spectacle out of him. And it was there when Samson was chained between the pillars there in the city that he was able, he regained his strength and was able to pull the pillars down and just destroy the that particular part. And you know, so goes the story of Samson. Gideon. Okay. What do we know about Gideon? Coward. Okay. Why do you say a coward?
Because we're playing the story.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't want anybody to find me in here. You know, Gideon was called by God, but he wasn't sure, was he? So you know, Gideon is one who tested God to find out, is it really God that's talking to me, or you know, did I just have some bad bologna for lunch here? You know, indigestion kind of a thing. You know, what's really happening? So, you know, we have the whole story of Gideon and the fleece and the dew on the fleece and, you know, and so forth, where Gideon's trying to be sure that indeed is it God that, you know, is sending me on this mission and so forth. One of the things about the story of Gideon that has always, you know, kind of fascinated me is when Gideon is, you know, he's going to take the Israelite army to go up against their enemies, and what is it that God tells him about his army? You have too many soldiers, okay? You don't need that many, okay? And so it ends up being that God tells Gideon to do what? You take them down there, you know, to the water's edge, and this is how he's going to, you know, weed out who's going and who's not. You know, all those that get down on their hands and knees and lap the water up like a dog, you send them home. And all those that get down on one knee and they pick up the water with their hand, then those are the ones that, that I want you to take with you. And so Gideon ended up with how many? 300 people to go against an army that is described as, you know, you can't even count them. There's so many of them. And so we look at that story and what's really the message in that whole part of it? What does God want Gideon to know, and what does God want you and I to know today? God's the one who's fighting the battle, okay? You're not going to be victorious because you have, you know, superior numbers and, you know, you have a better force and better trained men and all that stuff. That's not the point. The point is, you know, I'm going to fight this battle for you, and you're going to be victorious because I'm fighting it for you, and I'm on your side. In actuality, when it all came down to the battle, how did it all take place? What did he need the 300 men for? Yeah, make noise. Stand up on the ridge and make a lot of noise, you see. When the trumpet blew, they shouted and, you know, and screamed and hollered, and that caused a lot of confusion down in the camp. And, you know, the folks down in the camp did what? They turned on each other, started killing each other. Now, did God have his hand in that? You see? So, you know, again, there's some really great messages in those stories. And so I just want to encourage you, there's a lot of interesting meat to put on our skeleton in reading through the book of Judges as to how God dealt with all of those various situations and circumstances that the Israelites continued to find themselves in, right?
Mm-hmm. And you can imagine what it's like when you wake out of a sleep. Because I know when I wake out of sleep, you don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
You know? Okay, you don't know what's happening. Confusion comes into play. Particularly if there's fire, mm-hmm, or something that can disrupt you.
Yeah, yeah.
And God told us exactly what to do.
He took care of business, didn't he? Yeah, so I'd encourage you to go and read the stories in the book of Judges about all this. Now, we come to the end of the book of Judges is where we find the Israelite people at a point where, you know, they've been on this cycle for so long and this just keeps going on and on and on. They find themselves again, they don't have any leadership, and this is where they finally decide, look, we're tired of this. We want to have a king so that we can be like all the other nations around us. So they decide they want to have this king. Samuel at that time is basically recognized as a leader of the Israelite people. But again, he's a religious leader. They recognize him, you know, as a prophet who, you know, God is talking to and so forth. And so for the most part, he's the leader of the Israelite people, you know, as a whole. But they decide they want to have a king, so they can be like all the other nations around them. What is that? Where's the message in that right there? What's the problem with that? Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Don't want you to be like everybody else. God purposely called them out to be different from everybody else, didn't he? As a nation. And so here they're rejecting God as their king, and they're rejecting the whole principle of them being a different people, a unique people that are called by God. They want to be like everybody else. And so God allows them to have a king. Okay, and we looked at last week in this particular section under the United Kingdom, we have Saul, who was appointed the first king. And then we had David. David was considered to be and referred to in the Bible as man after God's own heart. Remember that I mentioned to you a while back again when we were talking about Abraham and Moses, and I mentioned to you three people that are kind of like the E.F. Huttons of the Bible. You know, when they speak, everybody listens. And when someone mentions their name, everybody listens because they are key people. And so we had Abraham, who was referred to as the father, Father Abraham. So when you mention Abraham's name, you drop Abraham's name, people go, "Oh, what are you saying about Father Abraham here?" Moses being the lawgiver, okay, when you mention Moses' name, and people were always bringing Moses up, especially in Jesus' day, Moses did this, Moses said that, you know, about the law and so forth. And now you bring in David, who is the king, you see? And the significance here is, when you put these three together, you've got Abraham, who the main significant thing with him is, not only was he the father, but he was the father of promise. Okay? He's the father of promise. In other words, he's the one that God gave the promise to that, you know, he's going to be the father of all nations, and God is going to bless him, make his name great, and through him, what was going to happen? All nations of the earth would be blessed, which refers to what? the Christ, okay? Then you have Moses comes along, and he's the lawgiver. God, through Moses, gave the law to the Israelite people, and the law was set in motion to do what? Exactly. The Apostle Paul says the law was a schoolmaster to bring us unto Christ. You say, it was to prepare. And you go and you look at the law of Moses, and we're going to be talking about the priesthood this morning in our worship time. Well, you look at the sanctuary, the tabernacle in the wilderness, and the temple, and all that are referred to by the writer of Hebrews as a shadow of the good things that would come. They are the earthly image, the thing that people could see physically with their visual, with their eyes. They are to give the understanding and the impression of what the real thing is in heaven. You see, that again, all of that, the sacrificial system and everything that starts with the Passover, as we talked about in that section, all of this under Moses to prepare the Israelite people for the coming of the Messiah. Now, when you look at David as the king, okay, what were the expectations, what were the prophecies all about concerning this Messiah that was going to come? Anybody recall? Right.
Now, David is from the tribe
of Judah. Right.
So the promise to David is you will always have a man.
That's right. Right. And the Messiah was understood. The prophecies had to do was the Messiah was going to come and do what? He was going to sit on David's throne. You see? And he would reign forever. Now, so again, all of this preparing the Israelite people for the coming of the Messiah, or the coming of Christ, one of the problems with that whole thing was is that they began, by the time that the Messiah did come, what was their understanding of those prophecies that were given concerning the coming of the Messiah? It was going to be a physical kingdom. It was going to be, he's going to physically sit on David's physical throne, and he's going to reign here. He's going to get rid of the Romans, and everything's going to be great, and we're going to have a freedom like we did, you know, under David, you know, and so forth. Going to restore the kingdom. Remember the disciples, when Jesus was getting ready to go back up to heaven after, you know, his resurrection, what was it the disciples said to him at that time? Lord, are you at this time going to restore the kingdom to Israel? You see, they're still looking for that physical kingdom, aren't they? To be reestablished just like it was in David's time, with the new king, the Messiah, sitting on David's throne and reigning over the physical kingdom of Israel. Okay? So you know, we see all these connections, you know, with these stories in the Old Testament to the New Testament. Now, after David's reign, his son Solomon, and this is kind of where we left off last week, Solomon takes over as king, as his son. And Solomon, when he becomes king, God tells him, ask for anything and it'll be granted to you. And what is it that Solomon asked for?
Wisdom.
Ask for wisdom. You need wisdom to be able to guide this kingdom. And God tells Solomon what? Right. Because you ask for wisdom and not riches, I'm going to give you both. Okay? And so under Solomon's time, Solomon was known as the wisest man that ever lived. His wisdom was renowned, you know, all over the known world at the time. His riches, okay, were just, it's amazing. Again, there's a lot of meat there. I encourage you to go and read. And if you have a study Bible where it gives the modern day equivalents of what he is, it's like, okay, Bill Gates doesn't have anything compared to this guy, okay? You know, the kingdom of Solomon and the wealth and the riches that he had acquired, it's just astounding. That God indeed, you know, followed through with that promise. Now, the end of Solomon's life comes, and we enter into a period of history referred to as the divided kingdom. Okay? So in the period of the United Kingdom, we only have three kings here. Okay? Saul, David, and then Solomon. In the period of the divided kingdom, Solomon's son, Rehoboam, takes over as king when Solomon dies. And, you know, Solomon imposed, as God had indicated to the Israelite people that would happen when they decided they wanted a king, he warned them. Solomon had imposed, in order to amass this great wealth and the kingdom and so forth, there was a heavy tax on the people. And now Solomon is dead, and the people come to Rehoboam and say, hey, you know, how about lifting our tax burden a little bit and make it a little bit easier on us? Rehoboam had some advisors who were not very wise. They were the young whippersnappers up and coming. And instead of listening to the old guys, to the geezer wise guys, you know, that had some wisdom and experience, he listens to the younger ones and says, hey, you think it was tough under my father? I'm going to make it even tougher on you. So the people rebelled, okay, under a man by the name of Jeroboam, okay? Jeroboam and Rehoboam. I always have a hard time trying to remember which one is which. I try to remember it this way. J comes before R, and we have two kingdoms. The northern kingdom of Israel is where Jeroboam became king. So J is over Rehoboam in the southern kingdom of Judah. That's just an easy way for me to remember which one goes where, because I was always getting them mixed up. So Jeroboam becomes the king of 10 tribes of the Israelite nation, that is from this point referred to as the northern kingdom of Israel. Okay? And Rehoboam is king of the southern kingdom of Judah. Okay? So from this point on, we're going to have this divided kingdom. Okay? Till we get to the point where we reach the captivity, which is coming up next. But basically what happens is the northern kingdom, Jeroboam in the northern kingdom, decides to set up two worship areas, one in Bethel and one in Dan. And what does he do concerning these two areas of worship? He brings back the golden calf, you know, the whole thing from, you know, when they were wandering in the wilderness from their history. He has some golden calves made. He puts one up there in a sanctuary in Bethel and one in the sanctuary in Dan, and he tells the people, these are your gods. The whole idea was to keep the people from that kingdom from going back to Jerusalem and worshiping there in the temple and rebelling against him and so forth. So I can keep them from out of there, we can keep them up here, and so that's what we're going to do. And so what we find in this particular period of time is this apostasy or this falling away from God's Word amongst the leaders of the people, the kings, is where it really starts out at. And we go through this period of the divided kingdom where as you go through and you look at the different kings and the chronicles, the kings and chronicles, as you go through, you'll be reading, you know, this particular king was king in Israel in the, you know, whatever, 22nd year of this king in Judah. He became king in Israel, and it's back and forth. And the records go into who's king when and so forth. But what's happening here is, throughout this period, there are some kings of the Israelite people who are basically just wicked. Okay? Probably the most notorious is who? Ahab. Okay? In fact, Ahab was so bad, okay, that most of the other kings, in terms of those who were wicked, are measured against Ahab. Okay? He was that bad. And of course, then there's also his wife, whose name that nobody else uses anymore today. Nobody, I don't think, would think of naming their daughter Jezebel, okay? Because Jezebel, okay, is associated with such evil, vile evilness, I guess, that people there, ain't no way, you know, but that's just not a name that you hear too much today, people naming, oh yeah, my name's Jezebel. Okay, nobody wants that name. But again, I think it's, you know, it's one of those things that you know, she was so wicked, she was so evil, in my opinion, she made her husband look tame, you know, as far as her evil and wickedness that she had. And so Ahab, in a sense, becomes the poster child, so to speak, for those who are the wicked kings, you know, during that particular time. But we also, during this time, have some kings that were good kings, okay? In other words, there were those kings like Ahab who, you know, they didn't follow God. They didn't want to have anything to do with following God. They worshipped idols. They did everything wrong that they could possibly do. Then you had those kings who, even some of them after, you know, their father died, who was a wicked king before them, they would come in and say, hey, we're going to get back to doing what God wants us to do. And they would try to turn the kingdom around, and they were very godly men. Okay? So we have this constant flux going back and forth during this period where some kings are trying to bring the people into obedience and others are just, you know, whatever. Then there's also a third group of kings, okay? We have a third group of kings who are somewhat moderate. There's some good in them and there's some bad in them in the sense that, you know, they do some reforms, but they don't do all the reforms. And they try to do some things good, but then they've got that evil side and, you know, back and forth. So this basically kind of describes this period of the kingdom or the kingdoms of Israel. Okay? And so and it's happening in both, okay? The kingdom of Israel, for the most part, is sliding down the path to destruction at a much more rapid pace than the kingdom of Judah is. Okay? Such that when we come to the period of the captivity, you see there the northern kingdom was conquered by the Assyrians in 722 BC. Okay, the Assyrians come in, they just take over, and if you go through your secular history, you read through there, you know, the Assyrians at this point are the world power. Okay, so they're going across the world and they're taking everybody into their kingdom and just kind of absorbing the kingdom and so forth. So the kingdom, the northern kingdom of Israel in 722 BC becomes absorbed into the Assyrian Empire. The kingdom of the southern kingdom of Judah is conquered by the Babylonians in 586 BC. So, you know, you have that difference of time there where the kingdom of the southern kingdom of Judah is, you know, again, there's that we're trying to do good, but they weren't doing it, you know, so they lasted a little bit longer. So what happens now during this particular time of the captivity is that the people are taken, okay, to Babylonia, you know, the capital of the empire and so forth. They're taken captives, brought from their homeland. But are all of the people taken? Here's some interesting things about this particular period in history and these leaders of the empires, the Assyrian Empire and the Babylonian Empire. From what I understand about these folks is part of their policies that they had when they were conquering the world, literally, okay? They didn't need all of these captured people, all of these slaves. They didn't need them all back in their hometown, okay? Where did they need them? They needed them throughout the empire, okay? So what they would do is they would take some of the captives, and usually the focus that they had on captives was a lot of the nobles, okay? Those that weren't killed initially in, you know, the battles and so forth, they would take those nobles and the families of the nobles. You see, those are the kind of folks they would take back to the capital area, so to speak. But a lot of the rest of the folks, they would either be taken and put somewhere as slaves and so forth, or they would be left in there where their home area was with people from other parts of the empire coming in and being over them in those areas. So we kind of have this It's not like every Jew that was there was captured and taken off, to Babylonia, okay? Which is an important factor here when we start looking at things later on in the Bible. In Jesus' time, we come upon a group of people who were despised by the Jews. This group of people were known as Samaritans. Where did the Samaritans come from? Yeah. Samaritans were basically a mixed breed of people. They were Jews that had, mingled with the Gentiles from, these different parts of the empire. So these people that had come in, were brought in, they intermarried with them and so forth. And so that's where they came from. But the Jews, pure Jews, looked down upon them because they were not pure Jews. They were a mixed breed of folks. And so this also has a lot to do with and shows the importance we talked about early on in our study, the whole issue of genealogies. Okay? Why is that important? Why would the genealogies be so important in all of this thing here? That the Samaritans were so excluded?
Part of it was trying to hold on to their national
identity. Yeah.
And they were always looking.
Exactly.
Even through the exile, they were always looking who could bring it out of
them. Exactly. And we know it's not going to be anybody who is not a Jew, because the prophecies and everything that we're looking at were coming, and a lot of those prophecies had to do either with the family line or the genealogy of Judah, who was going to be who? The Christ, okay? And it also had to do, and we're going to mention this morning a little bit later on in our worship time, it had to do with the genealogy concerning the family or the tribe of Levi, because that was what? The tribe of the priests. And in order to be one of the priests, you had to be able to be shown that you were actually from the tribe of Levi. And since this group of people, these Samaritans, were intermarrying with Gentiles, then that automatically excluded them from all of those rights of Jews and the promises and everything as far as the Jews were concerned, because they were no longer pure Jews. And they were not entitled to all of the promises of the inheritance and so on and so forth. Okay? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Grandfather,
I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, you look at people like Rahab. God was continually using Gentiles for different situations. The Israelites, because they missed the major portion of the promise that God gave to Abraham anyway, that it was through you that all nations of the earth would be blessed, But the Israelites during this time, they felt a certain exclusivity. Okay, is that a real word? Okay. They felt this certain exclusivity. In other words, they were the chosen people. They were God's people, and nobody else was, period. Okay? They had privilege and so forth when it came to God, and anybody else that was not a Jew was excluded from all of that. Okay? And this is where this group of Samaritans eventually, that where they come from. So there's this intermingling going on and so forth, this whole group of people that end up kind of becoming a nation, or so to speak, not really an organized nation, but a group of people unto themselves, known as the Samaritans. the Israelite people, their nobles and the families of the nobles and so forth, end up in captivity in Babylon, and we find some very important figures. Again, some of those typical Bible stories that we learn about, you know, as we're growing up in Bible classes and so forth, during this particular period, who are some of these important people? I'm sorry? Daniel. Okay. And who else? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Okay, the three guys that were on fire for the Lord. Okay, all right. And then you have Daniel, you know, who you know, almost becomes lion food, but the Lord spares him. But that's during this particular period, okay, of time. What is known as the captivity. Now, how are we doing time? We've got about 4 or 5 more minutes here. Let's look at the return from captivity real quickly, and we'll finish up here. After this period of time, which was how long? About, was it 70 years? I think it was 70 years. Somebody check me on that. I think it was 70 years that the Israelites were in captivity. They begin to come back. Okay? The Babylonian king at the time, Nebuchadnezzar, okay, it's time to start sending folks back and so forth. We have a fella by the name of Nehemiah. Okay? And Nehemiah has a pretty important position with the king. And these kinds of things help us to see, again, what's going on, you know, when the nation conquers, you know, a nation. They take these nobles and people from noble families and they put them in positions, you know, of power and authority and trusted positions and so forth within their own kingdom. And Nehemiah had such a position. Okay? Do what now? Yeah, he was a cupbearer to the king. Okay? Now, what does that mean? If you're a cupbearer to the king, how trusted are you? You're probably the most trusted person as far as the king is concerned because the cupbearer did what? He tasted the food before the king ate it to make sure that somebody wasn't trying to poison the king. Okay? So the king had to trust the cupbearer. Okay? And apparently the king had such a relationship with Nehemiah that when Nehemiah was troubled over the reports that he had heard, there were, in the return from the captivity, it was not just, you know, open the gates and everybody leaves at one time. There were groups that were allowed to return, you know, a little bit at a time and so forth. We have one group of folks that went back and they're concerned with rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem. Okay? And so that work is set about. Nehemiah's concern and his task was what? Rebuilding the wall around Jerusalem. Okay? So when Nehemiah, you know, got news that the city was, you know, torn apart and that the walls were all torn down, he was greatly distressed by this, and the king could tell something was bothering him. You see? And so Nehemiah requested of the king the opportunity to be able to go back to Jerusalem to see what he could do about that and so forth. And so Nehemiah is tasked with, by God, rebuilding the wall around Jerusalem, organizing that work to be done and so forth. Some really interesting things that are said about that particular event, the events that are recurring or concerning the rebuilding of the wall and so forth. So again, some great lessons, you know, in there for us with those. So the people are gradually allowed to migrate back to Jerusalem and to that surrounding area and to be a people again, okay, a nation again. However, we'll finish up with this. They are really, from this point on, never going to be their own self-governing nation like they were before the captivity. They're going to be a nation. They're going to be a people that are kind of gathered in that area as well as those who are still scattered around. And some of these things have to do with the prophecies where God is saying, when He's warning them through the prophets before the captivity, you know, look, if you don't turn around and start doing what I say, I'm going to scatter you all over the place, but then I will gather you back unto myself from wherever you are. So they're gathered back, but they never become a powerful nation like they were beforehand. And so we'll see from here, we're going to look at the period after the captivity, what's referred to as the intertestamental period, and then we're going to get into the New Testament from there. All right? So you see where we just went through a whole bunch of time in Bible history in 40 minutes. All right? Thank you all very much.
Thank you, brother.